Warming waters and shifting currents are changing the economics of the fishing industry. Atlantic fish and shellfish have been making their way north for a while. North Carolina's fishing quotas are now more commonly filled by boats off the coast of states like New York and Rhode Island. And lobster? That industry has all but collapsed in Long Island and Connecticut, with federal data suggesting the registered lobster catch dropped some 97% in just two decades.
Global warming is being blamed for lobsters leaving the Long Island Sound and instead moving on to cooler waters off of Maine.
It left Maine's industry booming. But those days may also be numbered. Data released in November suggest its ocean waters are among the fastest warming on Earth. Industries adapt. When Atlantic cod supplies crashed in the 1990s, companies scoured the map for other options. Many of our best-known fish products, Gordon's Fish Sticks and McDonald's Filet-O-Fish, now come from Alaska's Bering Sea.
On the last several years, we've seen a shift in the northern Bering to being warmer. And so is it just the random occurrence, or are we looking at a true trend? The suspicion is this is a trend.
And this year, fishermen are facing higher fuel costs as boats are going farther to find these fish. If that continues, what might it mean for consumers and the supply chain?
You know, a few nickels, a few dimes make a lot of difference in fish price when you're talking the volume that we do.
You can't say, oh, I wish we had done this yesterday. I mean, and we're not even looking at tomorrow. We've got to be looking years and decades ahead.
If the fish they depend on leave, where do they turn next to find seafood for a growing population of consumers? Over the next few weeks, we're taking a look, in real terms, at what changes to our climate might mean for the fishermen, farmers, and businesses putting food on your dinner plate. We explore how advances in artificial intelligence, gene editing technology, and big data might help. It's part of a Wall Street Journal series, The Price of Climate.
The Future of Everything, a look ahead from The Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
So this is the Bering Sea. This is where we're all fishing. Mm-hmm. That's our two company vessels. Here's the Russian Line, for instance. That's how far up north we are.
Craig Cross is a manager with Aleutian Spray Fisheries, a large commercial fishing company based in Seattle, Washington. The tracking system he's showing us on his computer helps fishermen in Alaskan waters find boats and fish in real time.
22 minutes ago, this is where he was. He was making 6.6 knots, so he's traveling. He's looking for fish.
Advances in things like sensor technology and vision systems are helping this industry become more efficient.
This isn't like the old days of the hunters. This is more about gathering. This is all about adaptability. This is all about how we will be able to change the way we fish and adapt to climate change and understand what's happening more than most.
With growing consumer demand for wild seafood and only so many fish in the sea, companies are learning to make each fish go farther to get more product out of less.
Fishing is a little bit of a crapshoot to a certain degree. Science helps us, absolutely. We get great science, but we know there's ups and downs. You've got weather. You've got, oh, we're on the fish, we're not on the fish. So you've got these things. We adapt so well to this just because this is what we're used to. This is what we do.
Carl Bratfold is an owner of one of Aleutian Spray's ships called Starbound, which I'm here to see with my colleague, science writer Robert Lee Hotz. Known as a catcher-processor, the ship's crew of 130 people are tasked with both catching and processing the fish in an onboard factory.
So we have our plant and our people and everything right with us. So we're out there and get that fish on board. We catch with a big trawl. This sounds kind of crazy, but we go through 400 or 500 tons of round fish a day. And we utilize almost 100% of the fish.
Instead of just processing fish into fillets, the crew also turns them into fish oil, fish meal, and a product that's used to make imitation crab. These days, there's virtually no waste.
Diversifying our product mix helped us in the global market.
To accommodate these new production lines, the ship needed more space. Lots of it. Weighing over 1,000 tons, the 300-foot-long ship was sliced in half, right down the middle, and lengthened an extra 60 feet.
This is where we cut the vessel, and then pulled it apart and put a mid-body section in the middle of it. And you'll see down there where the fish meal plant, fish oil, and all that stuff is in.
At sea, the crew uses a combination of tools to track fish and the currents they ride in.
So we also have a sonar mounted on the net. So in the opening of the net, It looks like a big sock. So it looks like it's 1,200 feet long, and it's the opening is roughly 100 feet tall by about 300 feet wide.
Underwater sensors weigh the catch. When it reaches 100 tons, a wireless signal is sent to the crew on board, and a crane hoists the net into the factory for processing.
Now we're going to go back into the factory again.
Uh-huh.
Hey, Leo, how are you?
Good.
In the belly of the ship, there's a system designed by its engineers to allow the vessel and its factory to be centrally managed.
You got a wrap hydraulic tank. Okay, there's the level in your tank. Deck hydraulic filters. Okay, you got a red one. You got a plug filter. So they can monitor everything basically from this room on the boat.
Here's where the fish they're not supposed to catch, the bycatch, are sorted from the 500 tons that pass through the system each day.
Every fish that comes on that deck goes across this flow scale. We have two observers, government observers, that work 12-hour shifts. They're down here all the time.
Next, the pollock flow through a hatch and slide down into the factory. A lightweight fish might go to fish meal or mincemeat processing, while heavier catches are sent through a fillet machine.
We run about 180 fish per minute per machine. Okay, the tail goes there, head goes here, guts go here. Every fish has got to go in that direction. They come through here, the head comes off of them, squirts the guts out. Guts go down here, back to fish meal. This helps brush some of the guts off. Then the gutted, headed fillet drops into these trays, and there's blades on here. There's like a razor blade. It's like a saw blade, but it's a razor blade. Two of those. And that fillet takes that fish out and lays it out like this. When it comes out the other end, it's a boneless fillet with skin on. And then they pack that into a plastic basket. The good fillets go up to be packed, and any defective fillets go to mince or either to surimi.
Surimi is a mix of fish bits, flour, and sugar, and it goes into things like imitation crab meat.
Okay, down we go.
And this is where the fillets get ready for the journey back to shore.
This is our freezer flat. It's all the refrigeration, so we can freeze up to, if we were just freezing fish, we can probably freeze 200 tons of product a day. With our product mix now, we're freezing about 160 tons of, you know, fillets or mince or surimi. That's about 160 tons. 5,000-6,000 gallons of fish oil a day on a production day like that.
The fish blocks are stored in a freezer hold. It's a cavernous space.
Echo!
Once the ship is full, the crew docks in Dutch Harbor, Alaska. This tiny town, home to just 4,000 people, is one of the largest commercial fishing ports in the country. After each trip, the crew spends 36 hours unpacking $2.5 million of fish and fish products. Fishermen watch fuel prices closely, as the cost eats into the bottom line. If prices go high enough, Brothfeld says he might burn fish oil.
That's one thing you're always playing with is fuel. So, you know, a little more efficient engine. You know, we make fish oil. We can also burn that in our boiler. Some guys have tried to run their engine, but right now, diesel is cheaper than what we're getting paid for the oil. If diesel's cheaper, you're going to burn diesel.
They're burning more fuel than usual this season because they're traveling further to catch these fish.
Why do fish populations vary? And can we project how that's going to vary moving forward? I'm Janet Duffy Anderson. I'm a research fishery biologist at the Alaska Fisheries Science Center in Seattle, Washington.
We met outside her office, which is perched along the shore of Lake Washington.
So we conduct ecosystem surveys every year in Alaska's large marine ecosystems, Gulf of Alaska, Bering Sea, Northern Bering Sea.
They figure out how many fish can be sustainably caught, and that's used to set commercial fishing quotas.
We use acoustics in order to be able to tell us where fish are occurring in the water column that we may not be able to sample with our trawls. We use plankton nets, which sample very small particles in the ocean that tell us what the prey are for fish. We integrate the information from all of these variables to give us an idea of what the ecosystem as a whole is doing in the current year.
But 2018 was different. So different, after 30 years of doing this, it led the federal government to call for an emergency second survey further north.
What I can tell you is that in the springtime, when we typically head north, ice is present in the northern Bering Sea, and our vessel that we use, the ship, can't get very far north because the way its passage is blocked by sea ice. In this case, we were able to get quite far north in terms of our sampling area because there was no sea ice present. So starting in springtime, we were able to sample an area that historically is covered in ice.
My colleague, science writer Robert Lee Hotz, wonders whether it means the northern part of the Bering Sea will start to look more like the southern part.
And if it is, so what?
It makes a difference in terms of the types of communities that are there. There are ecological winners and losers to some extent. And the communities in the northern Bering Sea and in the Arctic are quite different than the communities in the southern Bering Sea. And that food web can change dramatically if we see some of these shifts.
And if it does change dramatically, I mean, is this just of consequence to the wildlife there, or are there broader ramifications?
Well, there are going to be broader ramifications because communities, industry rely on the resources that are present there. And so if there are a change in the resources that are present, there's a direct impact on communities and industry. And we want to monitor that and give as much information as we can in the most timely way possible so that people can understand and adapt to that.
To understand how the production or how much fish or how much everything you have up there, you have to understand the physics. My name is Phyllis Stabenow. I'm a physical oceanographer at the Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory in Seattle. I mainly look at the oceans in North Pacific, Bering Sea, and the Arctic. I collaborate heavily with fisheries, trying to understand how bottom-up or how the physics controls or influences the ecosystems.
Things like temperature, salt, waves, and currents dictate what plants and animals can and can't live there.
So in the Bering Sea, the northern part historically has had 5 months of ice. The south is much more variable. So the northern Bering Sea is a benthic community. It's really driven by what's on the bottom of the ocean. While the southern Bering Sea is a more pelagic, i.e. water column species. And that's why you see most of your pollock, Pacific cod, that type of thing, are really dependent upon the southern Bering Sea because that's where the ecosystem supports them the best.
She says warming ocean temperatures are changing how these underwater communities function. She and other scientists are finding fewer pollock and an increase in other species, including rockfish.
The trend is about losing 1 day of ice per year, which doesn't sound like a lot, but over 40 years, you now have 40 days less of ice on average. So now we're sitting on this question, have we crossed some type of a line? And I don't know if we have. To make any conclusions, we need data.
But fisheries and other businesses can't afford to wait.
You can't say, oh, I wish we had done this yesterday. I mean, and we're not even looking at tomorrow. We've got to be looking years and decades ahead. My name's Greg Jeffers, Director of Purchasing at Gorton Seafood.
A company that in the past year represented almost a quarter of all frozen all right. prepared seafood retail sales in the U.S.
All right, we're just going to go upstairs. We're going to wash up and go onto the production floor, okay?
Gorton's has been in existence since 1849. This is our primary processing facility here in Gloucester where we're headquartered. We've been producing here for a long time and continue to produce all of our products here. Let's go look at fish sticks because that's what you probably grew up eating and a lot of people did. A lot of people still do. Fish sticks are still really cool. So this is a fish stick line. This happens to be minced fish sticks today. We make fish sticks from both minced pollock and single frozen pollock. Blocks are cut into sort of planks or logs that are put into a linear cutter and cut into the traditional fish stick. Batter is applied and then a breadcrumb, traditional golden crunchy fish stick. That's what we want to deliver consumers. That's what they're used to. That's what they love. Fryer, packaging end, fried, goes through the freezer. 52 count. So that's a fish stick line. Okay, go see the packing end now.
Smells amazing right here.
Using robotics, each of the bags is open in preparation for filling by the scale. This is one of the products that we've recently done the renovation on, moving towards single frozen Alaskan pollock. If we were to line up all the fish sticks that we made in a day, end to end, be about 78 miles of fish sticks a day on one line. So think like from here to Fenway Park and back. Something like that. Probably about 1.5 million fish sticks cross this line today.
Gordon's has been operating in Gloucester, Massachusetts for nearly 170 years. It was a fishing hub from the 1620s, making it the nation's oldest seaport and birthplace of commercial fishing in the U.S. But those once thriving docks are a shadow of their former selves, with most of the company's fish supply now coming from the other side of the continent.
Exactly.
I assume the boats used to pull up here, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, there's a reason the plant is on the water. Basically, in the 90s, the supply here became untenable as far as its ability to meet the requirements for certainly frozen value-added seafood.
It was built here 170 years ago. Because this is where all the fishing was happening. And over time, we've just had to evolve our total supply chain to stay in front of like global migrations of fish, the global sustainability of fish, and just kind of do our part to be good stewards of the ocean while delivering seafood to our millions of consumers.
That's Gavin Kennedy. He's the director of consumer marketing at Gordon's Seafood.
This company like is still in Gordon's. It's still Gordon's of Gloucester, but our fish comes from international sources, a lot of it mostly from Alaska, right? Because that's the most sustainable fishery now as, you know, the seafood market changes and as seafood patterns change and, you know, sustainability challenges come up. It's our jobs to stay in front of it and we'll Absolutely. Keep adjusting.
Among the things Gordon's is preparing for is a warmer climate.
Climate change is happening. We need to understand what the impact is going to be. Look, it may be that the fish just moves farther north, and then our supply chain, the infrastructure around our supply chain, is what has to react. I mean, maybe it's just, well, the pollock aren't dying off. Pollock are just moving someplace else. So you have to move, again, whether that's the new Dutch harbor is someplace that has yet to be discovered or farther north in Alaska or something like that. But I think our greatest concern will be when we start to see not only maybe if fish are on a consistent trend moving, but on a consistent trend we're seeing supply compression or something like that. It's a hunter-gatherer supply chain. So you're at the mercy of whether it's Mother Nature and or global climate change or ecosystem impact. It's not predictable. So you have to do the predicting for it. You have to understand what you're going to do and how you're going to evolve to be able to deal with that variability, because if you don't do that, the only alternative is you're not going to be there. And we're a seafood company. That's what we do. So we're absolutely hell-bent on understanding what's going on, looking way forward.
All the fisheries that could exist really exist now. There's not going to be a new surprising fishery that comes out of nowhere. And there's quotas. And we need those quotas for the health of the oceans. So wild capture seafood is not growing. But seafood consumption needs to grow because population's growing.
The question of supply isn't going away anytime soon.
Obviously, there needs to be more effort put on aquaculture, doing it the right way and doing it sustainably so that we can meet those demands of a growing global population.
But aquaculture or fish farms are known for things like parasites and the use of antibiotics.
Does aquaculture get a bad rap? It does. I think we have to do a better job of educating consumers about the benefits of aquaculture. And again, if done right, it's a great way to supply nutritious products sustainably.
There's growing interest in land-based fish farming. Canadians already buy genetically engineered salmon from biotech company Aqua Bounty. Other companies such as True Shrimp aim to raise seafood in places like Minnesota.
What are the next species? What are the next developments that have to happen? Some of this could even be non-seafood proteins that have to be evolved to meet consumers' needs. So we've got to look at all of it, you know, whether that's a vegetable-based protein or some combination there.
Things like imitation tuna and smoked salmon are made using new technologies and ingredients, such as synthesized algae and cultured fungi. It may sound like a stretch, but a tomato-based product called ahimi is already being served as a tuna sushi alternative.
Whether that's understanding aquaculture, whether that's like helping other fisheries that are behind get up to the standards that we can feel better about buying from them, or whether it's exploring like totally new technologies to just understand how we can deliver seafood one way or another.
One of these new technologies is cell culture, or meat that grows in tanks of liquid containing everything it needs to develop. This lab-grown meat doesn't involve killing animals. It's also faster to produce and without the carbon footprint. A company called Finless Foods is making bluefin tuna.
We're always going to be trying to stay in front of developing the next best thing. And that might mean we don't want to be reactive. We want to start doing the work now to say, what is that next species? If it's an aquaculture species, what is it going to be? Let's help build that market.
The big question is, will consumers be on board? Not so long ago, that same question was asked about cattle genetics and breeding technologies such as embryo transfer. Ranchers already breed in heat resistance and qualities impacting the marbling and tenderness of beef. Next episode, we explore advances in gene editing technology that could take the guesswork out of that process. The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode of the Price of Climate series was also reported and produced by Robert Lee Hotz, Emma Silikens, and Anthony Green. Our technical director is Jacob Gorski. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong.
And remarkably not that fishy smelling, considering we're on a fishing vessel, until the fish meal.
And, well, the fish meal is just kind of, that's the nature. It just kind of gets into everything, that dust and stuff. You just, that fish meal smell smells good to me. It smells like money. But it's a little bit, and this is...